Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. I'm speaking today with Gaza-born Sarah Kashawi, a graduate in sociology from Vancouver Island University and an advocate for the human rights of the citizens of occupied Gaza. In 2011, her family moved away from Gaza for safety reasons, eventually settling in Vancouver Island in Nanaimo. Now 23 years old, Sarah's culture and her first home remain very much in her heart and mind. Sarah has joined us today to help us understand what it's like to be connected in so many ways and so deeply to a setting of such extreme and invasive violence. Sarah, I think perhaps the first thing you might talk about is the very latest development concerning Gaza. A few days ago, a 20-point ceasefire plan prepared by the government of U.S. President Donald Trump, whose leadership continues to be deeply supportive of Israel and its military, was accepted by the Israeli government and by Hamas. It led to a cessation, for now, of the killing and rampant destruction of infrastructure that has characterized the last 24 months. So, Sarah, what's your reaction to this new development? How's it affected you, and what do you think of it?
I think, so with the ceasefire, when we were hearing about it, it was the same as we were hearing about all the other deals that were not agreed to and didn't come into effect. And even the ones that did, is what's the guarantee that Israel is going to actually stop? Because funnily enough, just this morning, a couple hours ago, Israel did break the ceasefire. And so there is that, looking at those deals, it's always a bittersweet feeling of, yes, there's going to be a stop to the constant destruction and bombing of Gaza. However, at the same time, no matter what the deal says, it's never going to be favorable to the Palestinians. It's always asking more from the people who have been genocided than of the people who have committed the genocide. And most importantly, it lacks any sort of one guarantee of a ceasefire for the Palestinians, and it lacks any sort of accountability for Israel that has been committing the genocide. And so, like I said, it's good that there's a pause in constant bombardment and the carpet bombing. However, is there really going to be a pause is a question that we're always asking. And what about all the other things that are, complicit in this genocide, like the invasion, the on-the-ground invasion of Gaza Strip? Because even after the first phase of that first ceasefire agreement, Israel would still have control of 60% of Gaza Strip. And even after they withdraw from that area, there is nothing about Gaza being under siege. So the idea here is that Gaza will remain after siege and Israel will still have control of, you know, the food supply, the water, the aid coming in and out. And so, again, third time, but it's a bittersweet thing. And we hope to see more coming out of it after phase one.
There have been other ceasefires, Sarah, and this one is not totally dissimilar from the others, but it has some new elements. Do you think it's any different from the previous ones in any way?
I think at the baseline, the foundation of it, the ceasefire agreement is actually pretty similar to all the previous ones that Israel rejected or tried to sabotage. There's really nothing new, and I think what really pushed the agreement in this case was the global outrage and reaction to what Israel is doing. By that point, there were over 50 ships in the flotilla that were going to break the siege in Gaza. There was a lot of talk. There were a lot of governments recognizing Palestine as a state. And so it would have been in the best interest at that point for Israel to agree. And as for the Palestinians, they have been under constant genocide. And I think a pause would absolutely be welcome, even if it meant going back to how things were. And so do I see it as different as the other deals? No, but I also believe that Israel sabotaged or didn't agree to those deals because they wanted to continue their genocide.
What are other people telling you, other people who are like you, deeply involved in what's happening in Gaza, you know, friends, family? What's the consensus you're hearing from people?
We're very grateful that it's there's a pause. It gives everyone a minute to recollect and a chance for Palestinians to go back to their homes. I'm hearing that from on the ground in Gaza, where people are happy that they could go back to their homes because that was definitely an uncertainty for people of Gaza City. And for people here, the ones mobilizing on the ground, we recognize and are in discussion about how this is our most crucial time to mobilize and organize. During, you know, we were asking for a ceasefire as part of our protests. That has happened. And now we move on to very important after actions. And so that's the conversation around.
Sure. I thought some of the provisions in the actual ceasefire writing, I'd be interested to know what you think of them. The second provision is that Gaza will be redeveloped for the benefit of the people of Gaza. And there's a little line after, who have suffered more than enough. Now, this is, you know, Donald Trump and his wording, and I'm sure he insisted upon it being a certain way. But have you seen that in previous ceasefire documentation, or has that been part of the kind of background of previous ceasefires?
Yeah, so the first ceasefire that happened during this genocide also had a reconstruction plan that was set to go into effect after phase one. And unfortunately, Israel did break the siege after phase one of that plan. And so it is not surprising. There is usually that clause in ceasefire agreements where it says the rebuilding of Gaza, the reconstruction of Gaza, and usually an Arab country takes that on to fund it. We're hopeful, again, that it will go past phase one this time. But like I said, approximately 2 hours ago, Israel released aerial, robots that or drones that were shooting at people in neighborhoods in Gaza. And so that's how they started breaking the ceasefire the last time. So really, not a lot of hope there. But again, that is usually something that will be in the agreement, is the reconstruction of Gaza. This time it will be more significant, though, because over 70% of Gaza's buildings have been absolutely reduced to rubble. 90% of schools and hospitals have been attacked. So there's going to be a lot of time to be able to rebuild.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of comment about people in Gaza right now feeling a sense of relief and even brief feelings of joy, compounded with strong feelings of anxiety, because this has happened before and it hasn't worked out. You told me when we talked earlier, you said one of the things that had been part of your life for some time was constantly checking your own email and social media, looking for news about injuries or deaths to family and friends. Is that something that at least for now you can feel more confident you won't be hearing as many, or if not any, bits of news about somebody who's been harmed or damaged or even killed?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. At the beginning, yes, very much so. Both in the first ceasefire and this one, the couple days beforehand and the first day, it was very, a slow down in anxiety that is constant around here. And so, yes, there is that, okay, there's a higher level of safety, if you could call it that. However, after seeing the killing of journalist Saleh Al-Jafarawi, and then this morning, 7 Palestinians being shot at, and while also seeing Palestinians discover booby-trapped, is, you know, when they go back to their sure. homes, it's either hidden inside toys for children, which is greatly alarming, or hidden under stones. And it's either surveillance tech or just, bombs that are set to go off. And so that makes me anxious again to hear about, because there doesn't seem to be a pattern of where they left these things or who they're targeting. It just seems to be random in true Israel fashion.
This is, of course, deeply alarming, and should be deeply alarming for everybody, including the people who are saying they're trying to negotiate the terms of this ceasefire. If Israel is disinclined to actually follow the spirit, let alone the letter of this agreement, then obviously it's going to make things extremely difficult. I'll just remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Gaza-born Sarah Khashoggi, a graduate in sociology from Vancouver Island University and an advocate for the human rights of the citizens of occupied Gaza. Now, because of all this, for the last 2 years, advocacy has been a central feature of your life. It's been something that's taken a lot of your time and energy and focus. For example, being the spokesman for the Solidarity Encampment at VIU, Vancouver Island University, which I have read is the longest running advocacy encampment in Canadian history, which I think is good to know. But also you've been organizing dozens and dozens of presentations about what's happening in Gaza. How have people responded, starting from, say, back 2 years ago till now? What have you observed in people's responses to your comments, your presentations, your actions?
I think it's pretty obvious what the institution's responses have been, from either suing students or suspending them. Mm. And so that's pretty clear, and we can follow that on the news. However, I would say the general public sentiment was very important, because that's who you want to react, and that's who you want to resonate with and raise awareness to. And so from the beginning, on October 12th was when we had our first rally.
Yes.
There was a group of people that showed up. It was a very well-attended protest. However, it was a lot of people that have already been involved in the cause for long before, longer than I have been even alive. And so, it's heartening to see all these people that have traveled from all over the island to come and join the very first rally, right? But at the same time, we could see or sense a lot of people that were, especially students, that were intrigued, but also really careful. What would they be supporting when they joined in this sort of conversation?
How many people, Sarah? How many people turned out at that first rally?
I would say around 50 people on campus, which for us, Nanaimo, October 12th, 2023, we thought was a great success.
Sure, indeed.
It drew attention of the media. And looking back at the picture, funnily enough, we could see a lot of VIU administration work. Part of the protest, but they were like sitting observing. The general sentiment was from the community, again, it was sit there and observe. Some people did approach to ask a few questions, but again, it wasn't like there seems to be clearly like there's a protesters and let's all watch them. By pretty much a month later, it was a more like there's a genocide going on and people were showing up to either understand or to protest the genocide and Canadian complicity. I think what also helped with that is that there entered the conversation of Canadian complicity in the genocide and how Canada is complicit. And that really brought it close home here to people on why they should be involved. We also would host actions that weren't very like protests. Like it was more like conversation. It was a table that we set up every single day called Ask Us About Palestine that still runs to this day, by the way.
Who mans the table?
It's usually Students for Palestine Committee and the VIU Muslim Women Club. So
okay.
This year it's run every Wednesday on campus in Nanaimo. Sometimes we do a hybrid one or we move it to a different location for just to engage with the community. A couple Sundays ago, we hosted it downtown Nanaimo. And so that offers a chance for people to have a low barrier, a low risk interaction to learn more and to have that discussion. Sometimes discussions did get a little bit intense, but at the same time, people were able to gather information, to gather petitions and to know about protests to then after which they showed up to. And so I would say the sentiment went from very carefully treading the line between we want both peace for both sides, to now what is, you know, what is going on and why there's no two sides in the genocide and we got to stop this.
Yeah, what you described to me initially was that there was a sort of a flush of sympathy for Israel after the initial October 7th attack and massacre, but that over time that has evolved into a very different feeling, and that is that the disproportionality of response has created growing sympathy for Palestinians, for the suffering that they've gone through, and that there's now a much more, perhaps more informed Canadian public to some degree. Would you say that that seems to be happening, that you can see?
Yes, absolutely. I think the initial response to following October 7th did make a lot of people either thread the line or stand on the line being peace for both sides, mm-hmm. or just turn completely to Israel's side, because there was a lack of understanding of, one, what had happened. Israel did immediately fuel media with a lot of propaganda and a lot of exaggerated accounting of events, or even just completely made up ones, right? And so that people seeing that, obviously it would have resonated with. It's hard to see anyone seeing 40 beheaded babies, for example, and not having some sort of reactions. Of course, I would too, right? And so at first, people were believing these types of things, and, you know, it would make sense. And there was also lack of understanding that these events didn't happen in a vacuum. It wasn't like it was two countries and the citizens of one country all of a sudden decided, hey, time to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And as that understanding started to settle in of, yes, Gaza was under siege, this is what actually happened on October 7th, this is what was initiated by Israel, and, you know, a debunkment of a lot of the things that they had put out, a lot of people started to, you know, understand the entirety of the occupation. And so it did definitely lead to some switching of sides, I would say.
The role of an advocate in a situation like this, of course, initially would have been seen as somebody who was bringing up material that was contradictory to what was coming from Israel and from various governments around the world. By doing so yourself, you became, for example, a spokesperson for the Solidarity encampment. And then eventually, even though you had actually received your degree in sociology, the university sort of retroactively suspended it. And now you're in the middle of a court case. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because you've just been to the Supreme Court of BC rather, to argue your case. What's that experience been like for you, this trajectory you've gone through in the legal system?
Right. It's not my first time going through the BC Supreme Court. It's my first time being on the side of the petitioner. The last time was when VIU was a petitioner and they sued students for the removal of the encampment.
Yes.
Right, among other things. My experience there was, it's a long and very detailed, sometimes boring process. however, at the same time, what VIU did and the suspension, even though it's retroactive, it has very intense, broader implications about who can control your freedom of speech and where they can control it too. Mm-hmm. VIU's argument was that they have location, or on their campus, there are locations that don't attract freedom of expression values. That is an alarming statement to say. I'm not sure why they thought that was their mic drop, right? But that is not only alarming for people who are advocating for Palestine, but it's for people who are advocating for anything else on campus that is important to them, that the university may not agree with, right? There hasn't been a lot of protests on campus, but however, we are seeing some start to pick up. There were people protesting the program cuts, for example, right? And so how VIU reacts to any protest that they don't want to be involved in, like, you know, the anti-genocide protests, they're going to be reacting to that way to all other protesters. So it's not exclusive just to Palestinians.
On that note, I would also mention that your lawyer, Noah Ross, is somebody who does see things in a broader sense. He sees this as yet another example of behavior that needs to be challenged. What's it like working with somebody who's also representing some of the people who protested at Ferry Creek and has had, you know, involvement in? In fact, his whole practice seems to be oriented toward the kind of thing that you've been involved with him.
It is, first of all, a great honor working with Noah. We met during the encampment, and he also was part of the legal team that represented us at the injunction hearing. So it's great working with Noah. It's also very easy working with someone who has some understanding of what the implications are of a suspension or VIU going after racialized students without having to explain every single little thing. VIU targeted two Palestinian women out of 25 protesters in one point, and we didn't have to explain why that's wrong to our lawyer. He had that understanding of it, and mm-hmm. it's always more comfortable, you know, working with someone when you don't have to explain every single little thing, every single microaggression. And he seems to have that understanding, again, from all the other cases on indigenous rights, or, you know, my people of certain minorities, right?
Isn't it interesting that a lawyer would be specializing in human rights? I mean, it seems like human rights should be part of every legal training program and a central feature. But Noah Ross has certainly carved out a path for himself in that regard. Now, I just want to mention another supportive thing that's happened, and that is just recently, Nanaimo City Councillor Hilary Eastmuir brought a supportive resolution to the Union of BC Municipalities meeting, which is a meeting of all the towns and cities of British Columbia, advocating for a complete arms embargo, two-way arms embargo between Canada and Israel, and also more support for Palestinian refugees. And it got some quite astonishing support. All of the big, well, not all of the big, but the large communities in the Lower Mainland, Victoria, Vancouver, North Vancouver, were all supportive. A whole bunch of other ones in the interior, Penticton, which is a large community, Kamloops, which is near to where we are here in Salmon Arm, all supported the resolution. There were 13 of them. What did that feel like for you as somebody who's been working away, you know, in your own time, on your own ticket, as they say? What's it like to see this public endorsement of some of the things that you've been stating very, very clearly for some time?
It's always good to see our own representatives do what we're asking them to do. The Nanaimo City Council has been part of our, actions. We show up at meetings, you know, with signs, you can be in the cameras. And we urged them to sign the first ceasefire petition that was going around to all of BC's councillors and mayors. And so three or four, I would say, was it Paul Manley, Ben Gasselbrock, and Tyler Brown, and Hilary Eastmuir? So that's four councillors of the Nanaimo City Council signed the first one. And these same four seem to be supportive of, you know, the ones that came out after. However, it was heartening to see that it was brought at the UBCM conference or convention. And it was good to see the support. It didn't, unfortunately, go through. However, it's always good to put people in a place where they have to actually do their job, first of all, as representatives. And it's always good to see who voted for it and who didn't. So we know, you know, we always know who to go after, essentially.
Indeed.
And who to email.
Well, the interesting thing about the UBCM is that it's based on each community sort of having one vote, or proportion. It's one vote per community. And yet, if you take the actual total population of the communities that voted in support, it's by far the largest proportion of the population of BC. They represent the largest proportion of the population of BC. So in a sense, you did get the support that most people felt comfortable giving. It's just that the way the system is structured, it didn't end up being passed as a sort of approved motion. I'll just remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Gaza-born Sarah Khashoggi, a graduate in sociology from Vancouver Island University and an advocate for the human rights of the citizens of occupied Gaza. Let's talk a little bit about what surrounds the people of Gaza in the form of Israel's military. Israel is a very militarized state. The IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, are the predominant social entity in Israel. They, not just militarily, but all sorts of other, in many other ways. And Israel has the fourth largest army in the world after, believe it or not, US, Russia, and China. Israel's army is the fourth in the list, bigger than Germany, France, England, all sorts of other countries that we think of as having militarized features to their country. Now, when you were young, living in Gaza, you were experiencing directly the things that happen when there's a war going on around you or a battle, and as we now know, a genocide. What was it like for you? You left in 2011. Before that, what was it like? There were times, especially 2007, 2008, when there was a lot of violent interactions going on. As a child, how did that affect you and your family?
I think as a child being in, born into this, it was very normalized to expect attacks from Israel. It was, you know, there was constant 24/7 drones that would surveil, you know, the areas, and those were made a constant noise, right? Like constant buzzing. That was 24/7. And so again, normalized. There was also the sound, breaking of sound barriers where they would fly, you know, jet fighters super close to buildings and things like that. And again, was it obviously scary as a child? However, we learned that to expect it pretty fast.
Your parents used a special word to describe an explosion.
I think most parents in Gaza or even in Middle East would pretend it's like a goal, like someone scored a goal. That would be the, you know, the uproar. Oh my God, a goal. And that was used with really super young kids and used by a lot of families in Gaza. And in Syria, actually, there are videos of families in Syria also using this technique. And that just replaces the feeling of, because it's immediate alarm when you hear a loud noise. Anyone's going to have any, like, an alarming reaction, regardless, before they know what it's for, right? And so when the adults who react faster than the kids say, oh, it's a happy sound. It's the same as a sound from, like, a goal being scored. Soccer is big, a big part of their culture. And so the kids immediately, you know, reroute that feeling to feeling of excitement rather than a feeling of fear. And so a good way to not, you know, traumatize your kids too much when you're living right under Israeli occupation. So there was
Israeli
that.
Bombardment more than even
ethnic cleansing.
it's amazing the roles that obviously your parents and other adults did to try and protect their children in any ways. But when you came to Canada and you were free of that particular threat, that those sounds, that if you heard a loud noise, it wasn't a bomb necessarily going off, did you find yourself reacting, you know, if you heard fireworks or if you heard a helicopter or something like that?
Yes. And I'd say very interestingly, it wasn't immediate for me. It settled in. It set in like 5 years later. Hmm. I think we were running on adrenaline. At least for myself, I was running on adrenaline for 5 years when we moved here. And so once those things settled, that's when I started having reactions. And I would say they really picked up about 4 years ago for me, where loud noises, you know, really startled me. I think there was one time a construction, like someone dropped something in a construction zone, and that kind of caused like some sort of blast. And that like really shook me up for a few minutes. And we live right by the hospital, so there's a constant helicopter going back and forth. The helicopter ambulance. And so sometimes if we're not expecting it or I don't hear it coming from far, we're like, oh no. Just that immediate thought,
This
is what's happening.
Yeah, that's the famous fight or flight reaction, the autonomic nervous system just saying, uh-oh, this is bad, we got to do something about it. Now, in Palestinian culture, family and family relationships are really important. And of course, with children exposed to such dangers, parents are really concerned about the safety and the health of their children. But family relationships are really broad. You describe one kind of family picnic that had, well, an enormous number of people. Why don't you just rattle off all the kinds of people that would come to a typical Palestinian family gathering? It was quite impressive.
Yeah. So obviously you'd have your immediate family, your siblings there. And then your parents would have their siblings there, of course, because you have yours, why not theirs? So your uncles and aunts are all there. Your grandparents' siblings as well, because why not? So your great aunts and great uncles, and those usually have their own, obviously, kids. And then their kids have kids. And then there's the fourth, which is our generation. And so everyone would be invited. So basically, we would start at my great-grandma, who was alive, and anyone in relation would show up to a bigger gathering. A smaller gathering would just include my immediate uncles and aunts, which were not a small number, and of course all their kids. Everyone has at least three kids, and so that would be the gathering.
You mentioned your great-grandmother. She was something like a model of self-sufficiency and independence. People have this idea of different cultures. They think, well, you know, men, women, who's dominant, but whatever. But your great-grandmother took no, she would take no guff from anybody. It sounds like she was quite capable of ruling her own roost, and maybe others as well. Do you remember anything about
her? Yeah, I do. I quite have the memory. I was the first grandchild on both sides, and the first great-grandchild on both sides, on her side too. But I was very... I spent a lot of time with everyone as a young kid. And so, I definitely have memories of also like eating her food. She was a great cook. We still talk about it to this day. And of course, spending time downstairs, she had the very bottom floor, the ground floor of the building, of our building. And so, I spent a lot of time there. And obviously, like, it comes up a lot in conversations. My dad was like super close with her, so it was, you know, that conversation and the stories that always come up of, you know, things that she would do or say that were very on par with her personality.
Your dad, speaking of your dad, he was working as a management consultant. He had an MBA in Gaza, and he was able to get work here and has been able to work all the time. That must have made a big difference for your family, having sort of a steady kind of secure material base. A lot of immigrant families really struggle that way.
Of course, something that we're super grateful for, that my dad was in an industry, I guess you could say, that didn't require a lot of hoops to get into when you move. And so, and what helped obviously was doing his MBA here in Canada. And so, and he also, like, his bachelor was done at a internationally recognized university in the West Bank. And so, you know, when he had those things set up, which, of course, helped us, you know, have a constant and steady source of, you know, of work. So we're very grateful for that. You know, thank God he wasn't a doctor. We had to equalize for, you know, another 10 years before there was, you know, any sort of trust in skills and in knowledge for him to work. And so, again, yeah, very grateful for it. It's hard work. I can see it. And there's a lot to, you know, get to, you know, getting that type of steady type of work.
Sure.
But again, he had that skill set and the knowledge and the education to do so.
Now, you mentioned one thing, and I'm not sure if this relates to your advocacy work, but that at one point he was actually doxxed by a Zionist organization of some sort. Was that related to you in some fashion? You visible?
He was doxxed as being my dad. I was doxxed And then it was like, here's Sarah Khashoggi, here's all of her information. And then, by the way, here's her dad, her mom, and her siblings. And yeah, so all of us were doxxed.
For people who don't know what doxing means, why don't you explain what it is?
Yeah, for sure. Doxing is when you release a lot of private information about someone in an attempt to, shine light on them. Usually what that leads to is other people using your name and information to sign you up for things. Like, we were signed for a lot of Israeli charities where people were making donations in our name. And what that also leads to in some cases, in some extreme cases, is you get swatted, like a SWAT team, and where people would port your address as, you know, having something in the house.
Some nefarious and activity in the house. Happens. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's happened to a lot more famous people. So thank God I'm not at that famous level and it hadn't led to anything.
Don't be
like
famous.
That.
Just a little famous, but not too famous.
Yeah. Yeah, just leave with the movement. But essentially, that's what Docs says, is they'll release where you work. Of course, that's a huge target, where you work, because they'll call your workplace. They'll file a bunch of complaints, and a lot of people will get fired from that just because the company is getting a lot of calls, not even because it's a valid concern. Sure. And it will lead your emails, usually all your accounts, and a lot of, especially in the movement. You could be put on something called the canary list.
Yes, or I've seen the canary list, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, people will dox you first, and then if someone in canary mission picks it up, that's where you get put. Don't want to, you know, I haven't been put on it yet, but it does, you know, obviously lead to a lot of attacks from Zionist groups.
Now, within your family circle, close family relations, lots of interaction with your own family of origin, also extended family. Talking about what's going on in Gaza is challenging because of the emotional freight that it bears. It is not a light subject. How do you deal with that in the family? You described kind of keeping things more at an intellectual level, sort of trying to avoid a sense of emotional paralysis. How does that work in the Khashoggi family?
Part of what helps is sometimes we disagree, or not, a lot of the times we disagree on a lot of things on an intellectual basis in the discussion or on political things. And so it helps depersonalize it when we're talking, you know, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Or what has happened here? What are the implications of that? There is a philosophical nature to a lot of these discussions, because it's what is Israel, for example, trying to do with this specific thing. And then you discuss things based on, you know, how you would think they would happen, right? And so that does a great work in depersonalizing it. If it does get personal, we're great at integrating humor into things. And so when our house was targeted by a tank, for example, you know, every time we talk about it, everyone just says, oh, it just needs to be dusted off, right? Or just light work, just dust the furniture, whatever. I mean, half the wall is gone, but just dust. And so a bit of humor, because, you know, what else are you going to do? And obviously a lot of intellectual discussions. When I'm talking with my cousins that are in Gaza, we both understand the horrors that they're going through. I mean, them, because they're going through it, but, you know, I see the news. And so obviously you don't have to be told about every little thing. And sometimes it does help for them to, you know, vent or get that out. But most of the time, the conversation is, you know, instead of saying, oh, you guys are getting displaced again, it's, oh, yeah, we're going on vacation to this, like, you know, really off spot in, you know, rural, whatever. You know, it's a tent, camping, room camping, or things like that, you know? And that stuff helps. It may seem absurd from outside.
No, Sarah, but it sounds brilliant. It sounds brilliant. It sounds like, Look at the frog costumes down in Portland, standing in front of the federalized National Guard. It's taking it into a whole new dimension, which the absurdity of it is palpable, and also it means that you don't have to just say the same words, you know, death, destruction, injury, pain, suffering. I mean, you can only say them so often before it starts to become, you become numb or paralyzed, as you use the word paralyzed. And I think that's a very good word. I'll just remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Gaza-born Sarah Khashoggi, a graduate in sociology from Vancouver Island University and an advocate for the human rights of the citizens of occupied Gaza. Now, with reference to education, because that came up in our discussion as well, education is being highly valued within Palestinian circles. It's something that really matters. It's a kind of an irony that that's also a characteristic of Jewish culture. Jewish culture values education. All the people have got, you know, Nobel Prizes for this and that, so many disproportionate number of Jewish people. And it shows something I think we need to just focus on for a minute here. And that is the difference between Zionism and Judaism, between the political and the spiritual side of this issue. And you were very clear about it when you talked about it before, and maybe you can just explain that to listeners.
I think it's very important to make that distinction between Zionism and Judaism, because being anti-Semitic is not the same as being anti-Zionist, right? Mm-hmm. And so we see the term anti-Semitism floating around a lot these days, and unfortunately that is a term that is being, in some cases, weaponized against the pro-Palestine movement. Mm-hmm. And that's when that distinction comes in, is that people are not against or discriminating against Jewish people. That's never the case. In fact, a lot of the movement is either led by or has a huge participation from the Jewish community. However, what anti-Zionism means is that it's against the political ideology, which is what Zionism is. And that is the idea that Israel has a right to occupy Palestine because Palestine is the homeland for Jewish people. However, Palestine is a homeland to Christians and Muslims as well. It doesn't make any sense for a group of people that are predominantly from Europe, not even ethnic Jews that are from originally Palestine, but these are, it's, you know, spread Ashkenazi Jews coming from Europe to Palestine to occupy and kick Palestinians out. That is essentially what Zionism is, and that's what the state of Israel is built on. It's a very complicated ideology that started making rounds in late 1800s and really picked up in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration, and then eventually in the occupation of Palestine in 1947-8.
You mentioned the Balfour Declaration, and most people who talk about the Balfour Declaration fail to note the last part of the Balfour Declaration, which says clearly and explicitly that nothing should be done as a result of establishing a Jewish state that infringes on the political and spiritual priorities and rights of the existing inhabitants there. And it's interesting how little of that comes out in public discussion. It's as if the Balfour Declaration was a green light to go ahead and do whatever you wanted in what was then called the Mandate of Palestine. And yet, in fact, the full letter, there's only like 137 words in it or something like that, the full letter actually is very clear that nothing should be done to infringe upon the rights of people already living there. And yet that, along with many other things, has flown out the window as if it never existed.
It would make sense that it would flow out the window because it doesn't really fit the narrative of Israel.
And so, right. Yes.
Yeah, it makes sense that it did. However, that clause, I would say, a little bit contradicts the entirety of the text previous to it, because unless it's taken in a way that people have the right to immigrate to Palestine, it seems like a thing that was added at the end to, you know, be like, in my opinion, though, you
yes.
know, just when you add that at the end, just saying that, just so you don't, when you give your friend advice, so you don't, you know, absolutely ruin their life.
Well,
it
doesn't even matter what it was interpreted. The words have been completely ignored as if they never had been written. So, mm-hmm. You know, the ultimate outcome is that there's only one part of the letter that ever actually is referred to. Now, coming to Canada and getting away from all the horrors that have taken place and are still potentially taking place in Gaza and in the West Bank, of course, which is going through a tremendous uproar with lots of attacks and even killings. What is it like to be in a country where you don't have to deal with all that, and yet it's present in your mind all the time? You said to me at one point, you said, I just can't sit there not doing something makes no sense. And I would imagine it would be almost impossible to act like it wasn't happening.
I would say, yes, in Canada, we're far from it. But, you know, we watch it. It's live. It's on our screens. We have access to it, what's happening. And even if Canada wasn't complicit, which it is, but even if it wasn't, it's hard to see actions taken against a group of humans without feeling that implication on ourselves and that effect on ourselves, even if we're not Palestinian, right? It's normal to have a reaction of discomfort and fear when we're witnessing these types of things, if they're happening even to other humans. And what's not normal, though, is to see those things and normalize them or not do anything about them, because a crime against humanity is a crime against all humans. But again, it's good to understand what's happening, and it's even better to go out and do something about it for the sake of the people that this is being done against, and in asking for our own complicity to stop. And also the smaller side of it, but a part that is very important, is for our own well-being. One, it allows our brain to not normalize what's happening, because when you see something constantly, your brain starts to normalize it. You become numb to it. You don't react to it. And so taking action against it, one, tells your brain to not regulate it. This is not normal. And two, it's a good way to express emotions. Watching these atrocities harbors very negative feelings. It's not good to keep these bottled inside. And unfortunately, we don't have ways to really let those out. You can talk about it to someone, you can vent about it, but that's just simply not enough if you're not doing anything about it. I mean, venting sometimes even doubles the problem, because you realize how messed up things are, but you can't do anything about it. And so taking that action in small parts also helps your own self regulate emotions so that you can keep going, but not normalize the action that is happening.
You said two things with reference to what you just said now. First of all, you said during an action of some sort, whether it's a presentation or speaking to somebody, whatever, you said, I always feel connected to Palestine, which I'm sure is inevitable because you are connected to Palestine historically and geographically, etc. But you also said something I think is quite interesting. You said you don't have any sense of moral superiority. And I think that's what sometimes gets lost in a discussion like this, that you're not coming at it from we're better than them. You're coming at it from we're all the same. We are all in the same boat. We humans, if you hurt one human, you are hurting in a metaphorical sense, you're hurting all humans. Why don't you talk about that? Because I think that's a very interesting point that you raised.
Part of our movement, our goals, and my own personal values is that a crime against humanity is a crime against all humans. We must all act out on it. And the way we set up our actions is an invitation for everyone to join. I actually did a talk at Vancouver Island University a couple of days ago at the Watermelon Seeds Literature Festival. And the main point of that was, you know, you don't go to protests based on what your work dress code is. If your work dress code is business casual or it's professional, you have to wear a suit or heels, that doesn't mean you're not invited to a protest or that you don't get to go, because a dress code for a protest is a little different. It doesn't mean you leave it to the student or younger people who are, rogue, I guess you could say. A protest for everybody. Everybody must react in these atrocities, and everybody must be uncomfortable, and everybody must see it as horrors, right? Mm. And so that is the way we go with things, and that is the way we invite people to join. Because it's on all of us to act. Because at the end of the day, it could wrap around. It's going to come to us, and we are going to expect everyone to react to us. So,
you know, there's also a practical side to this. At the moral level, as you said, harm to one person is harm to all. But also in terms of your own presentations, if you made the comment to me earlier that if I say I'm connected to Palestine, then some people in the audience kind of turn their brains off. Whereas if you say I'm talking about any harm, which I think is a broader and more accurate way of doing it, it means that people don't do that. They don't sort of say, oh, you've got one issue that you care about, but not other issues. And it's a very powerful thing to do. I think it makes perfect sense. I'll just remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Gaza-born Sarah Kashawi, a graduate in sociology from Vancouver Island University and an advocate for the human rights of the citizens of occupied Gaza. You touched briefly on Canada's complicity. And one thing you mentioned, which I'd forgotten about, was that Bob Rae, who is Canada's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, sat through Benjamin Netanyahu's entire speech. A number of countries' representatives walked out at the United Nations when Netanyahu was speaking, but Canada did not. How did that make you feel? I don't think you felt good about it.
Absolutely not. I think, first of all, we've been knowing that Bob Rae is a Zionist. It's not a secret. And he is always a target of emails that, you know, actions that is online is always email. To urge Bob Rae and other representatives to, one, represent their own people, and two, to take action that would stop the genocide. In terms of Bob Rae not walking out of the assembly, that was a symbolic gesture. If anyone really, really wanted to hear Bibi Netanyahu speak, they could just access it online after. I mean, I watched it and I wasn't there. I would have walked out if I was, right? And so people that walked out, that was symbolic. It shows that Canada still backs up Israel. And so it is alarming. Does Israel really need your symbolic support that much to where your representative will not walk out on a genocidal maniac? And so that's a lot of the feelings it would come up. And it also brings up a lot of questions of who would you sit in front to hear speak? You know, how back in history can we go mentioning names that the Canadian representative would sit there and listen just to show symbolic support?
Indeed. We're coming near the end of the show, and I wondered if you could kind of think back over what we've talked about today and what you're doing out, you know, in your life these days. What is your sense of the future? What is your sense of where this issue will go? This astonishingly vivid example of humanity's inhumanity to itself.
I think right now is the most crucial time for us to revamp how we're looking at it. I mean, our goal was to ceasefire, and now it's a good time to reconstruct and look at the things that come after. That includes rebuilding Gaza, but that includes accountability as well. That accountability is already starting. Someone did report the Prime Minister of Italy or the head person of Italy to the ICC for their complicity in war crimes. And I'm hoping that we would see and even be involved in a lot more actions and campaigns like that. And so for the future, what we hope to see is a continuation with the movement. It definitely picked up after 2023. It put Palestine back in people's minds, and it allowed a lot of people to get educated about the occupation. And that, of course, is the ultimate goal of the movement, is that, for Palestine to not be occupied and for it to be free and for the liberation of all Palestinians. And obviously the Palestinians' right to return home, all the way back to the people that were kicked out in 1948, right? And so that is the ultimate goal. And we hope that the momentum that the movement has picked up over the past 2 years following October 7th is, you know, would continue to eventually get to that goal. And to, of course, to get to the end of Canadian complicity in the genocide, but also in the occupation, and the end of all the institutional support that Israel has through investments.
You know, Sarah, there are many people who are at 23 years of age not thinking about the breadth of issues that you're thinking about these days, and thinking about them in such a mature way. I think we all could get into situations of conflict and challenge in our lives, and we all have an opportunity to respond to them and be brilliant and adequate and broad thinking and that, all that kind of stuff. But it doesn't always happen. I can see the role of learning, the role of understanding, the role of family support, and your own intelligence and awareness of things coming through in spades as you've been with us today. You're an inspiring representative, not just of the Palestinian people, but of people everywhere who want a better world for all of us. I want to thank you very much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me and providing the platform to speak about Palestine and our activism.
You're most welcome.